I'm Gabrielle Drake, and I'm Nick Drake's sister. And I'm really here sort of for Nick, who is not.
Indeed.
And I'm Joe Boyd, and I'm was a producer in the 1960s and came across Nick thanks to the efforts of Ashley Hutchings from Fairport Convention and produced his first two records.
Your brother is one of the most well-known, most influential, least known about artists in existence. And I know that was a run-on sentence, but that's what the research told me. Because as I've got pages and pages and pages and pages on my computer that told me lots of things, but, you know, the truth and the stories and the reality that go beyond the legend. And legend is an appropriate term here, because when a man only made that many records, only lived that long and influenced so much.
Well, I think that one of the reasons for the strength of Nick's music and the fact that people are so influenced by it and is the very fact that he was never in San Francisco. He was never part of, didn't have a rock and roll life. He was a very English musician who came from a very, is influenced tremendously by his home, which Gabrielle can tell us a bit about, and by his mother, and by a very particular, his own particular take on a lot of things which other people were listening to. And he never really joined in with the world of the 60s. And so his music has a strength of individuality, that it isn't the soundtrack for the 60s in any way. It kind of sits outside all of that, and I think is all the more powerful for that.
Right. It wasn't what, and the thing is, we spend a lot of time in this room avoiding the word influences, because every band that comes in here, the last thing you want to say is, who influenced you? We'd rather hear it in their music. Now, in Nick's case, let's go to it, because I know that, you know, let's talk about growing up. Let's talk about your mom, because I know that on, you know, Family Tree, there's some amazing, amazing things.
Well, we have put a couple of my mum's songs on Family Tree. My mother actually composed songs all her life. She was never a professional musician, but she was a wonderful amateur. And we grew up in a house where music was around and prevalent all the time. We didn't think it was anything particularly unusual. It was just the way that you grew up. And my mum was always composing new songs. When we were children, Nick and I, my mum was always composing songs about us. from the time we were babies onwards, really. In fact, I thought that I really grew up thinking that if you couldn't compose a song about your child, you couldn't have a child.
Well, and I, you know, Nick used to tell me in a kind of slightly dismissive way, well, you know, my mother writes songs. She plays the piano. She writes a few songs in a kind of amateur way. And he kind of
sloughed it off.
Yeah, so he didn't really, you know, but he did that with everything. He was never somebody to grab you by the lapels and say, you got to listen to this. He was always very offhand about everything. And I met Molly, who was a wonderful, delightful woman. And I was in the house and I saw the piano in the hallway and the pieces of music paper scattered on top of the piano. And you know, but it never, you know, you're young and I was thinking about Nick and I wasn't thinking about mom, you know. And it wasn't until Gabrielle some years ago handed me one day this cassette and she said, you might be interested to hear. These are some copies of some songs that my mom recorded. And I remember taking them home and playing them and going, wow, this is incredible, because you can hear so much of Nick's particularly harmonic sensibility. You know, everybody who writes about Nick's music talks about these strange tunings that he had on the guitar. And I'm not an expert on, you know, the structure of the tunings or anything like that, but it just seems to me that having heard Molly, that those weird tunings were the only way that he could get the guitar to sound like his mother's piano chords.
And we're going completely, completely out of order here. It was probably question number 42 down the line, but it's an interesting segue. One of the stories that I read about why Family Tree finally came to be was that people were showing up, you know, unexpectedly to learn more about Nick. They would just literally come to the house and say, and reel-to-reel tapes were pulled out, probably the originals, I would imagine, scarily enough.
Well, yes. I mean, my dad, who actually also was very musical, and indeed he too in his youth composed songs, just in an amateur way, but he was an engineer, and he brought to our home, long before anybody else had one of these things, a huge reel-to-reel tape recorder. And as children, my parents would record us, or my dad would record me and my brother and my mother singing and playing. And of course, when Nick started to compose, or when he started to play, all these songs were recorded. By that time, I suppose we had graduated to a cassette recorder. He had some quite sophisticated recording equipment for that time. And after Nick died, really, although he was quite unknown, even in those very, very early days after his death, there were people who were interested in his music. And these young people would show up at my mum's and dad's house, and they'd be taken in. My parents would welcome them in and take them to the room, which we called the music room, where Nick would sing and play, and even in the depths of his depression, he'd go into this room and sit for hours on end practicing the guitar. And my dad would play them these home recordings, and then, because he was always keen to try and get my brother's music known, of course he made tapes for these young people. He gave them tapes of my brother's songs, which I'm quite sure my brother would have been really horrified by, because he was nothing if not a perfectionist. But anyway, somebody or other took one of these tapes and turned it into a bootleg, and the quality was so really horrible. We thought we had to do something about it. I mean, I don't think that if these bootlegs had not existed, we'd never have done anything. I mean, Joe and I actually listened some years ago, didn't we, to these songs, and we thought there was nothing really.
Well, you know, I'm, you know, I don't come to this free of prejudice, you know, because as a producer, you know, I worked with Nick, and I know we both, and John Wood, the engineer who worked with us and produced Pink Moon, and we were all very perfectionist in a way. We wanted everything to be really, really good before it went out anywhere. And so I've always been, with not just with Nick, but with any artist, I've always been a bit wary of the kind of complete outtakes idea. You know, just because I think of the artist and what they would have thought of it.
Might not be them. There's so many of them that people are clamoring for yet, you know, another Dylan bootleg or another whatever. You know, pick any artist you want. And it doesn't always show them in the best light, you know, for sure.
Not at all. I think so. And anyway, because the bootlegs proliferated to such an extent,
you had to do something.
We thought we had to do something to make a CD which was reasonable in price and the best quality that we could affect, in fact. So that was what we did.
What was the most amount of units that any Nick Drake record sold?
Well, I think the Volkswagen commercial was never shown in Europe.
Right.
And starting, I would say, about 2 or 3 years after Nick's death, as Gabrielle said, there were people who would knock on my door, knock on her door, knock on her parents' door. There was a growing interest. And if you look at the sales figures starting in 1979, 80, 81, every year more records were sold, until before the Pink Moon commercial, I think there was about 30 or 40,000 units a year being sold.
Yeah.
And then there was this big spike because of Pink Moon. But I think if you look aside from that, overall, there's this trend that started at the end of the 70s. Every year it gets bigger and bigger. And I've had some wonderful conversations with people who describe in the 80s starting a new relationship, and after a few dates, either the girl or the boy says to the other person, Do you know Nick Drake's records? And they say, no, who's that? And then they say, well, I better play them to you.
Nick Hornby would call that a high fidelity moment.
Yeah. And there's the message was clear that if you don't get Nick Drake's music,
this relationship
has no future. And so many people told me that they learned about Nick's music through a romance. You know, that was a kind of key moment.
That's a great effigy, isn't it?
It is, yes. And the other thing that I think is very moving, and which I'm really pleased about, is that Nick's popularity has not come about through any kind of market force or pushing or advertising. It's been completely fan-led and fan-driven. And it's due to word of mouth and his people who love his music spreading the word about it. I mean, you organized a charity concert in London at the Barbican Theatre.
Yeah.
And I went to Universal at the time, and they had not even heard that it was going to be happening. And the whole of the Barbican were sold out, and we had to quickly summon together forces to get the CDs to be able to be sold at the time.
Right.
But they knew nothing about it. The fans knew all about it.
And but to be fair, there was, of course, Volkswagen. We have to speak. But I think it's an interesting thing that a lot of people were kind of shocked that how could we, as the people who love Nick's legacy, tolerate him being in a car commercial. But I think I remember there a lot of stuff had been turned down, and my first response, because the request used to come to me initially in those days, was, oh, no, car commercial, no. And then they said, well, we're going to send you the storyboard. And I remember looking at the storyboard and saying, and calling up Gabrielle and saying, I think actually this is kind of interesting. And as it turned out, it's an extraordinary ad because it's more of an ad for Nick than it is for Volkswagen.
Yes.
The only sound you hear other than the slam of a car door and the crunch of gravel under the wheels is Nick's music. There's no voiceover. And so it's Volkswagen obviously liked it and thought it did them some good because they kept running it for a year and a half.
2 years, I think.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think, full marks to Volkswagen for this, because it really was a sort of commercial which wouldn't have been obvious to people. But I mean, I think that they're the sort of firm that actually, can take a risk with something, and it really comes off as a classy piece of work.
Well, a little piece of very obscure information for the listeners here is that the ad was originally conceived around a track called Midnight Ride by The Church. And the whole thing was drawn up and planned. And I met the people who did it, a young advertising agency in Boston. And the night before they were finalizing it to send it to Volkswagen for their approval, this guy who I met, he was wearing a bobble hat and a kind of unshaven guy, with a lumberjack shirt, he got stoned the night before listening to music, and he put on Pink Moon. And in the sort of midnight, the night before the presentation, he said, that's it. That's what we should use. And he went into the agency the next morning and said, hey, guys, forget the church. Let's use this. And they all went, wow, yeah, cool.
How did Nick feel about the fact, here he is with Chris Blackwell, he's on Island Records, he's on a powerful label, he's surrounded by artists that are selling hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of records. And in his heart and soul, Chris Blackwell believed in him and kept him on. Did Nick ever talk about the fact that he was the underdog in a world where all these other people that were probably more, I don't want to say that they weren't as original, but I will say that, because I think in this venue I can get away with that. That, did he ever talk about that at all?
I think he did to you, Joe,
sure.
Didn't he?
Nick wanted people to hear his music. I mean, he was ambitious. He wanted to be successful. That was why he was writing music. And we agreed, I recognized that Nick was not somebody who you could throw out there unknown in front of an audience, and he was going to tell jokes and his charisma was going to win people over and build up a following so that when a record came out, it was going to immediately sell. We had to do it the other way around. And one of the reasons I asked you to bring the Leonard Cohen record today,
which we're going to play in a couple of minutes,
is because You know, when Nick played me his songs, and we talked about, he mentioned the fact that he had played at a May ball in Cambridge with a string quartet. My immediate thought, from a number of points of view, was about this Leonard Cohen record, because it had come out a year before, and Leonard Cohen at that time was, his attitude was, I'm a poet. I don't perform. And so he refused all of the requests by Columbia Records to do concert tours. So the record was just out there on its own, no support of touring, and it sold 100,000 copies in its first year. And this was a, and so this was an inspiration to me. I thought, well, if Leonard Cohen can do it, we can do it. And so, and also I think John Simon's production was wonderful, and it was a very, there was no real maps for this kind of production except that record, in a way, and maybe the Judy Collins In My Life record for a kind of non-pop production of songs with, a, you know, very tasteful strings and kind of, I don't know, there's something about, it was new, that sort of idea of how you would make a record. And I was very influenced in the way I approached Five Leaves Left by the Leonard Cohen record. And I thought, we'll put this record out, and it's going to, immediately, people will beat a path to our door. And they didn't. And I feel that, in a way, it was a lack of imagination on my part as a manager producer, that my only response to it was, well, we got to make an even better album. Because we did send Nick out on the road, we did set up a tour, and there were a couple of occasions where the atmosphere was absolutely perfect and people sat and listened respectively and they loved him. But most of the time, people were buying drinks, they were clinking glasses, they were talking. Nick had to retune his guitar between every song, and people would lose attention. And he got so depressed, and he called me up in the middle of the tour and said, I want to come home. I can't do this anymore. But I know that he was tremendously frustrated that the records didn't sell. And he, at one point, much later in the early 70s, when he was much more troubled and having a much rougher time, he actually kind of lashed out. He said, everybody tells me I'm a genius, but they don't buy my records. You know, what's missing? What's wrong? He was angry. He was upset.
And do you think he was, in answer to the question that obviously was never possible to answer at the time, do you think he was ahead of his time? It's one of those very, very hard things to put your finger on. But I can point to, unfortunately, a lot of the great musicians who are not with us. You know, it's easy to say ahead of his time, but what was the time, you know?
Well, I think, you know, if his music had become really successful in the 60s, you would have seen documentaries about the 60s with Nick's music as a soundtrack, and then Nick's music would have become identified with that era, and people might have even said the late 60s was the Nick Drake era. You never know. But it didn't happen. It was the opposite. It completely was unknown in that era, which in a way I think has helped people describe Nick's music as timeless, because it's not identified with that period. People didn't grow up in the late 70s or the 80s with their parents putting on Nick Drake records all the time and them getting annoyed with their parents playing this music at them. People of each generation can make it their own, because it's sort of outside its time, because it never had an impact on its time.
Well, what I'd like to do is we'll play some stuff, you know, afterwards, that I'll do in the studio afterwards. But this is a rare opportunity. Because I have you in the studio, you will tell me what to segue from Leonard Cohen into.
Excellent.
So I'm going to do that, and then we'll let the listeners find out what we're going to do.
Okay.
Come over to the window, my little darling. I'd like to try to read your poem. I used to think I was some kind of gypsy boy before I let you take me home. love to live with you. But you make me forget so very much. I forget to pray for the angels, and then the angels forget to pray for us. Ah, so long, Marianne. It's time that we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all. We met when we were almost young, deep in the green lilac park. You held on to me like I was a crucifix as we went kneeling through the dark. So long, Marianne, time that we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all again. Your letters, they all say that you're beside me now. Then why do I feel alone? I'm standing on a ledge, and your fine spider web is fastening my ankle to a stone. Now so long, Marianne, it's time that we begin. Hidden love, I'm cold as a new razor blade. You left when I told you I was curious. I never said that I was brave. Oh, so long. Laugh about it all. Oh, you are really such a pretty one. I see you've gone and changed your name again. And just when I climb this whole mountainside to wash my eyelids in the rain, oh, so long, Marianne, time that we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all.
Never do what is proper. my fair share of labor. I'm a poor boy and I'm a rover. Count your coins and throw them over my shoulder. I may grow older. Nobody knows how cold it grows, and nobody sees how shaking my knees. Nobody guesses how steep my stairs, and nobody smiles if I cross their stairs. Where will he stay tonight?
of dreaming. Poor mum, poor mum, whatever became of your scheming? Nothing worked out in the way that you planned. Nothing was quite as you thought. Try very hard not to misunderstand. Joy as it flies cannot be caught. Poor mum, where did you take a wrong turning? Poor mum, pack up that last little yearning. Pack it away with the books and the toys, silent and dumb, silent and mum. Go out and grab at your life and forget you were poor, poor. Mom?
Your mom kind of a little bit of self-pity there?
I think it's an ironic commentary, really, on the position of all mothers. You know, their children are producing whatever they are, launching out on life, and their problems are all important, you know, and there's my brother singing Poor Boy, and sort of, it's an ironic sort of being sorry for himself. And my mum replies with, well, sort of, you know, there is actually another side of the story, there's poor mum as well, you know. But it's not really self-indulgent, because the last lines are, go out and grab at your life and forget you were poor, poor mum. And that was really, that was my mum. She was in many ways, sometimes a fragile person, but in other ways a very strong person. And it was a terrible tragedy, of course, my brother dying. But even when he started to become famous, she always knew that she could not simply conduct her life as the shadow and mouthpiece for my brother. She had to live her own life too.
Nick's art came from, you know, this quite sheltered life that he'd led in a way. He didn't lead a rock and roll life. He wasn't out at age 14 playing electric guitar in pubs and, you know, forming groups and you know, all the rough and tumble that is part of the story, even of a lot of solo artists. You know, they start out in a band and then they go solo or whatever. He was never, you know, he went to a very nice boarding school. He was at Cambridge. He was, and in a way, he was surrounded by people like Robert Kirby, like his other friends at Cambridge, who loved and nurtured what he did in the very protected world of Cambridge. And so that his shyness and his diffidence about talking on stage or whatever didn't really matter. And when he decided, you know, based to a certain degree on the enthusiasm that people like myself showed for his music, to leave Cambridge and come to London and become a professional musician. The fact that he wasn't able in a way to match that step of going into the music business with going out and playing every night in a club and going on the folk music circuit and touring around and doing all those things, he sort of kept this, he tried in a way to keep this very, this cocoon around himself, which he created for himself in a little bedsit in Hampstead. And I think that there was always a tension between those two sides of Nick. He wanted to be part of this world of commercial music, but his nature was not really cut out for that. And I think that there was a, it wasn't an immediate shock, but I think there was an elongated shock to the system in terms of realizing the difference between the world that he had been in and the world that he was now in and trying to compete in.
What I'd like each of you to do, and we can do it right here, can you, each of you, pick a favorite Nick Drake song that I will now pop into the CD player?
Well, I think I've got two, really. That's the trouble. But you've got, wait, want
oh,
me to make a...
Oh, we can do that.
You see, it's quite a... I love Saturday Sun.
Okay.
And I also love Mayfair. Because I think that both songs are slightly different from what everybody says about Nick. And Mayfair is a wonderful, ironic, humorous song. And people don't really associate irony and humor with Nick.
it's tricky. I mean, I have very strong feelings about so much of Nick's music. And one of the things that I would like to say as just a little footnote about producing an artist like Nick, and one of the things that was such a pleasure for me in working with this guy was the guitar, because Nick's guitar playing is so clean and so fluent that it's almost too easy to take it for granted that it's just part of the sound of Nick Drake. But if you really listen to it, it's incredibly complicated and played with incredible clarity. And having that guitar part as a spine to fit other things around when you're mixing a record is such a luxury and such a pleasure. And so I'd like to choose a track like 3 Hours.
Okay.
As a classic example from Five Leaves Left.
Saturday sun came early one morning, in a sky so clear and blue. But Saturday sun came without warning. No one knew what to do. Saturday sun brought people and faces that didn't seem much in their day. When I remember those people and places, they were really too good in their way, in their way, in their way. But Saturday about stories with reason and rhyme, circling through your brain. And think about people in their season. Turning again and again and again and again. But Saturday sun has turned to Sunday. Saturday sun and wept for a day gone by.
Yeah. All right, right.
Mayfair strange in the morning light. Mayfair strange in a summer night. Mayfair strangest in the afternoon. Mayfair stretching far above, full of fame but lacking love. Could it be we see the Mayfair moon? Mayfair strange across the park, in the day or in the dark. There's no need to walk or even run. Mayfair faces clean and nice, but beauty here is cold as ice. Could it be we see the Mayfair sun? Mayfair strange at every hour, hidden frowns with mystic power. Starry heights and golden throne, down below you're on your own. Mayfair strange for passers-by, sights of wonder for the eye. Could it be that they'll pass by again? Mayfair calling far and near, for even trees are wealthy here. Could it be we hear the Mayfair rain? Mayfair strange in the morning light. Mayfair strange in a summer night. Mayfair strangest in the afternoon. Mayfair stretching far above, full of fame but lacking love. Could it be we see the Mayfair moon?
What would be, and I imagine it would be interesting to play something off Family Tree, what would be a great closing song that would kind of sum up everything we've talked about here, which of course we could probably just go through the entire catalog to do it properly, but given the...
Well, this is a track that I wasn't involved with, but it's from... you know, the Nick kind of had the last laugh because I was incredulous when he said he wanted to make a record just him and guitar.
Right.
But I think Pink Moon is a magnificent record, and I think if we finished with For the Morning, it would be a nice way.
Well, I was just going to say that perhaps it would be... You know, it's interesting, the very first song of Nick's that we know about is this song called Princess of the Sands, which he wrote when he was in Aix-en-Provence. And that was the first song that I ever heard of Nick's when he came back home from that trip to university in France and played for myself and my parents his what he'd been doing over there. And it was the first time that we realized that Nick was really going to follow sort of in his mother's footsteps and write songs. That was the first one.
All I can say is that it's just wonderful that you are both here to help, you know, celebrate what was an amazing, amazing career.
I think that I ought to say thank you to you on behalf of Nick, because I think that he would have been really, in his quiet, reserved way, so thrilled to the very depths of his being to be so celebrated by people like you. And so thank you.
Day one stormed, and it was beautiful. A day one stormed from the ground. Then the night she fell, and the air was beautiful. The night she fell. Look, see the days, the endless colored ways. Go play the game that you learned from morning. from the ground. See, she flies. She is everywhere. See, she flies all around. So look, see the sights, the endless summer nights. Go play the game that you learned from the morning.
Recently, which means I'm likely to forget the words. Deep down in the depths of cotton dreams, so far away, so long ago it seems. The memory comes of a distant beach with the pale sand stretching far from reach. It was then I found my princess of the sand. As I traced the foam with the pebbles beneath my feet, I looked behind and I saw this one so sweet. She came to me and I saw in her eyes the heavy toll of a thousand sighs. I called her my princess. She stared at me and my mind was in a maze. As we moved along in a summer sea dream haze, she moved her mouth, but it made no sound. The message she brought can never be found. But I called her my princess in the sand. One moment we walked with the night breeze in our face. Then I looked, she'd gone, of her presence there was no trace. Where she went or came from, who can know if she'll ever return to help me know who she is, my princess of the sand. Someday when the summer nights come back, I'll go back to the sea and I'll follow that sand-swept track. I'll look around and I'll hope to find that strange young dream. I'll call her my princess.
Words. New City Lakes. That's my surrealist song. It's crazy. I know it's sort of funny dream.